All right, if you have your Bibles, please turn to the book of 1 Corinthians, 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And we've spent several weeks going through these few short verses, talking about God's love, what it is and what it isn't. And we started off by reminding ourselves that God's love is an attitude, right? Love is an attitude. An attitude is a lens through which you view the world, right? An attitude is a system by which we determine how we're going to respond to the things that are going on around us, right? So you could be having, or you know, things could be going well, but you could still have a bad attitude, right? Or things could be going not so well, but you could still have a good attitude. Right? And so your attitude is a choice that you make, and it's a system by which you determine how you're going to respond to the issues of life. And so we talked about the fact that love is an attitude, and we talked about the fact that that love, or that attitude of love, is foundationally kind and it's foundationally patient, right? We talked about the fact that love is not self-focused. It doesn't think about me all the time. It envies not. It doesn't vaunt itself up. It's not puffed up, right? That's that idea of self-focus. And then the last several weeks, we've been looking at verse 5. And verse 5 starts off by saying that love does not behave itself unseemly. And that word unseemly is inappropriate, improper, out of context. Well, what is the context for our behavior? What is to govern our behavior? Christ-likeness. So when he says that love does not behave itself unseemly, what he's saying is love does not behave itself in a way that is inconsistent with the character of Jesus Christ. And we summarized it by saying love is not rude. Right? And so we talked about that. And then it says that love does not seek her own, and that's the idea of love insisting that everything be my way, and so that's the idea of manipulation. And so we talked about that last week, that love is not manipulative, right? It doesn't make threats. It doesn't seek to get its own way. The goal of confrontation when it takes place is not to convince you to abide by my standard, right? And we talked about the opposite of manipulative threats is natural consequences, right? It's okay as parents to say, hey, you know, if you don't buckle down and get good grades, you know, you're not going to be able to get into a good college. You're not going to be able to get the education that you want to be able to go into the field that you want to go into, right? And so it's not a manipulative threat to say, hey, you know, I'm confronting you for the sake of growth in your life that will ultimately prove to be to your benefit, right? Manipulative threats is you need to do things my way or else, right? And so we did talk about that difference there. Well, today I want us to look at the last two things in 1 Corinthians 13:5. We've already talked about not behaving unseemly. We've already talked about not seeking her own. But 1 Corinthians 13:5 concludes with this phrase, speaking of love, that it is not easily provoked, and it thinketh no evil. All right? And so we need to ask ourselves, what does it mean to be easily provoked? Well, the Greek word there is the word parahaxus, or parahaxus. And para is just a preposition, right? From, of, with, by, at, near. The translation of the preposition depends on the case of its object. And so sometimes it's one way when it's with an accusative, or it's a different word when it's with a genitive. And that might not make sense to you, but that's okay. But para is just a preposition. But the word oxus, it means to irritate. It means to stimulate negatively. It means to make something sharp. It means to exasperate. And in my study of this word, I saw several places it mentioned that this word oxus is also tied to a word where we get the word acid. Right? You can kind of see that A-C, the ak, right? Acid. Well, what does acid do? Acid is something that eats and erodes and damages, right? And there are positive applications for acid, but acid is very dangerous, is it not? And you got to be really, really careful when you're handling it. Why? Because it eats and it erodes and it damages. And so we see here all of this in view when he says that love is not easily provoked. Right? And so there's that word provoked, but we also see in our text in front of us, we see this adverb, easily. He says love is not easily provoked. And we need to be careful that we understand what he's talking about, because if we don't understand what he's talking about, we might be tempted to think that it's okay for us to be provoked. It's okay for us to fly off the handle. It's okay for us to get really, really mad and start lobbing threats at people as long as we don't get there easily. All right? And so we need to understand what he's talking about here. And if we don't understand what he's talking about here, we may end up contradicting the truths of Matthew 18 when Peter says to Jesus, well, how many times am I supposed to forgive my brother? Seven times? And Jesus says, no, seven times 70. And that doesn't equal 490. That means you need to forgive him as often as he sins against you. And then he gives that parable of the servant, right, where he was forgiven an unpayable debt. And then he goes and he's harsh on his friend who owes him a very payable debt. And so the application of that passage was that we need to be very careful about having an unforgiving spirit, right? And so we need to make sure that we don't miss what he's talking about with this phrase easily. Well, interestingly enough, in the Greek text, that adverb easily isn't there. It's not there. And so in the Greek, it simply reads, ou paraxous, not provoked, right? And so why the addition of this word easily? You know, why is it that we have an adverb here that isn't here? And in fact, several other English translations don't include this word easily. A lot of them just say not provoked or not angered. So why this word easily? Well, the Bible reminds us that there are times and there are places where righteous anger can be appropriate, right? And when I say righteous anger, I mean passionate opposition to evil rather than a concern for myself and my own well-being and my own standard of practice of right and wrong, right? Ephesians 4, verse 26, it says, be ye angry and sin not. It says, let not the sun go down upon your wrath. And of course, when we think of righteous anger, we most often think of Jesus in Matthew, is it 21? Matthew 21, where Jesus has his triumphal entry, and then he goes into the temple, and when he gets into the temple, what does he see? He sees the money changers, right? He sees the livestock market, right, where they're selling animals for sacrifices, and they're exchanging money, and they're profiting off of worship of the Lord. And we remember that Jesus goes in there and he overturns the money tables and he drives out all the livestock and those who are selling them. And what does he say? He says, this is supposed to be a house of prayer, but what have you turned it into? A den of thieves, right? He's quoting the Old Testament there. And so Jesus displayed anger, right? Jesus got angry, but his anger didn't stem from a violation of his own ideology of what was good, bad, right, wrong, or good for me, right? His anger in that context came from what? Opposition to evil. And injustice was being done against God the Father and against the temple, and Jesus was very rightly angry about that, right? And so perhaps the word easily here is not a reference to the span or the duration of my endurance, right, or the duration of my patience, but perhaps that word easily is a reference to trivial things, right? things that are selfish, things that are about me, things that are of no eternal consequence, right? Love is only provoked over injustices against God, His Word, and His image or His will. And so I can rightly be angry when it comes to things like human trafficking. Why? Because God's image, God's will, God's name, that's all being violated. That is wicked, evil stuff, and it is okay for me to be angry about that. But when it comes to an injustice that's committed against me, hey, so-and-so didn't treat me the way I thought I'm entitled to be treated, love does not get provoked over that. Love says, I love that person enough that I'm going to get angry that they are not being valued as an image bearer of God. That person is being human trafficked or whatever, and that's wrong. I can get angry over that. Love can get provoked over that. But love is not easily provoked. Love doesn't get angry and irritated, exasperated over things that are self-seeking. I wrote here, it doesn't allow things to eat at it and make it sharp and harsh towards others. Love doesn't get angry about me. All right? And so all of that is in view when he says love is not easily provoked. And Karl Barth, he says this. He says, love cannot alter the fact that my neighbor gets on my nerves, but it can rule out my allowing myself to be provoked by him. Hey, if so-and-so is not going to treat me correctly, I can't help that. And I can't be like, well, because I love you, it's just all of a sudden not a problem anymore. No, if injustice is being committed, but love says, I'm not going to allow myself to be provoked by your actions. I'm going to stay right with God, and I'm going to respond the right way no matter what. And so he says that love is not easily provoked. He also says, though, that love thinketh no evil. And so we need to ask ourselves, what does it mean to think evil? Well, the Greek here is the word logizomai, which is the middle voice of the word logos. And that's a word that probably a lot of us know. The word logos simply means a word or a spoken word, right? And perhaps the most well-known usage of that word is John 1:1, right? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, right? In the Greek, it says, and arche hein halagos, kai halagos, hein pros tu ton theon, kai theos, hein halagos, I think is what it says. Jim knows. Pastor Jim knows. But anyways, that's the word, right? And so the word logos, it means a word, right? A spoken word. Well, in the middle voice, logizomai, it refers to the words of the mind, right? It refers to logic. In fact, my guess is that's probably where we get the word logic, right? That L-O-G, logos, logizomai, logic, right? And so logic has to do with the things that I set my mind on, right? The things that I ponder in my mind. It's words of the mind. And so this word, logizomai, it means to ponder. It means to evaluate. It means to take mental account of or number, to measure or weigh, to meditate, or to determine or purpose a thing, right? And so when it comes to an application of this phrase, what Paul is saying is, he says, love does not dwell on wrongdoing. Love does not keep score against injustices. And because of that, love does not purpose or determine to do evil towards others. And so all of this is in view when he says that love is not easily provoked. Love thinketh no evil. And if we wanted to kind of summarize that all into kind of one snapshot, we could say that love is not temperamental, right? Love is not temperamental, right? Well, what does it mean to be temperamental? Let's see if this phrase kind of matches up to what Paul is saying. If you Google a definition for temperamental, here's some things that you're going to see. You're going to see liable to unreasonable changes of mood, All right, you're going to see marked by excessive sensitivity and impulsive mood changes, unpredictable in behavior or performance, easily angered or unreasonably emotional. All right, some synonyms of the word temperamental include moody, volatile, impulsive, unpredictable. It means overreacting, right? Temperament, right? Being temperamental has the idea of overreacting to things that don't meet my view of what is good and right and best. And so this idea is a very self-focused idea. It's a very self-focused view, which we've already talked about, by the way. And we've talked about the fact that this self-focused view is very antithetic to godly love. And so being a temperamental, moody, overreacting, impulsive person, being easily provoked, taking score of evils, all of that is directly contrary to the kind of love that God is calling for us as believers to put on, right? And I want you guys to notice something in these definitions, all right? First of all, we see the word unreasonable twice, okay? We see references to mood changes. We see reference to behavior and performance, right? We need to understand that your temperament, a temperament is a matter of the mind, logizomai, but it impacts your actions. It comes out in the way that you react. It comes out in the way that you respond. It comes out in your actions. And so this ties into what Paul's had been discussing with the Colossians, right? What did Paul say to the Colossians? What's our phrase? What you know to be true will determine what you do. And so if what I believe to be true is in fact not true, will my actions be right? No, my actions will be based on a lie. My actions, my response will be wrong. But if I have the right view of God, if I have the right view of others, if I have the right view of myself, then what I know to be true about God, His Word, and myself will come out in my actions and I will respond rightly. And so this ties into what Paul was talking about with the Colossians. It also ties into what we talked about in 1 Peter. It ties into the need for us as believers who want to thrive. And we do want to thrive, do we not? It ties into the idea that for us as believers to thrive, we need to add to our faith. And we need to add things like virtue, commitment to doing what's right, knowledge, understanding the character of God and how that impacts my situation, self-control, the ability to say no to worldly, fleshly desires and responses, and endurance. What is endurance? Endurance is planning ahead and anticipating hardship. All right, I already know that I am going to suffer injustices this week. It's going to happen. People are going to do it to me. I'm going to do it to them. It's going to happen. And so endurance says, I'm going to plan out now how I'm going to respond so that when it happens, I'm ready for it. I've already pre-programmed myself to respond the right way, because how many of us would say, in the heat of the moment, I always do the right thing? How many of you would say, in the heat of the moment, I always do the wrong thing? Yeah, my mentor, Harry, he says the decision made on the spot leaves the spot, right? And so all of this is in view, but lastly, this ties into the idea that love is an attitude, right? That's where Paul started. Love is an attitude. And I've got another phrase for us. Your attitude will determine your actions. Do you guys believe that? See, we already know and believe that what you believe to be, or what you know to be true, will determine what you do. So let's add to that. Your attitude will determine your actions. Let's all say it together. Your attitude will determine your actions. See, if life is going horribly, but you have a good attitude, does that impact your actions? Yeah. If life is going really well, but it's just not enough for me and I have a bad attitude, is that going to impact my actions? Yeah. You know, I don't know if you guys are ones that write down quotes. I used to do that a lot with Pastor Monroe, who was my pastor growing up. I've got all kinds of good stuff. In fact, I pulled out my notebook yesterday, And I was looking through some of them, and there were some in there that I had forgotten about. But these little sayings, they're good for us, right? Because they're easy to remember, but they're packed full of truth that's useful for us. What you know to be true will determine what you do. Hey, if I'm having a hard time responding right, maybe it's because I'm not thinking right about this situation. Maybe I don't have all the facts. Maybe my attitude isn't right, and because my attitude isn't right, my actions aren't right. And so all of this is in view when he says that love is not easily provoked and love doesn't think evil, right? Love is not impulsive. Love is not unreasonable. Love is not moody. Love is not excessively sensitive or unpredictable, right? Love is not temperamental. And Solomon actually echoes this sentiment in Proverbs 25, and this is a verse that if you don't have it memorized, I would strongly encourage you to memorize it, because this is another one that can really be a help to us in the heat of the moment. Solomon says in Proverbs 25:28, "He that hath no rule over his spirit is like a city that's broken down and without walls." Think about what Solomon is talking about here, right? You know, he lives in the period right before the divided kingdom, right? And so this is Bible times, and so you have these cities, right? And these cities have walls, right? And oftentimes very thick walls, right? And sometimes you would put a moat around the wall, and you'd dig it real deep, and you'd put water in it, and you'd fill it with all kinds of stuff, right? Alligators, crocodiles, math teachers, whatever, right? All kinds of unsavory characters, right? No, I like math teachers. I did really well in math. Right, but if the walls were broken, right? If the walls were broken, what did that mean? That meant the city was exposed, and any foreign group, any foreign army, any foreign raiders, any foreign entity could easily come into that city and take control over it. Why? Because its walls were broken down. Its protection was lacking. And he says, if you can't control your own spirit, you're like this city that doesn't have walls, and any foreign entity can come in and exert control over you. And so these cities, they would put these walls up to protect themselves from foreign people taking control. And as believers, what we need to do is we need to build up the walls of our heart, and we need to protect our hearts, we need to protect our spirits, because if we don't, we are opening ourselves up to allowing anybody and everybody to come in and take control of us. And by the way, who is the only person who is called to exert control over me? Or that I'm told to let exert control over me. I should have said that. The Lord. Yeah. So if I'm allowing you to control my actions, in a manner of speaking, is that idolatry? And so all of this is in view. And it's the idea of, if you can't control your temperament, then someone's going to come in and control it for you. If you can't keep yourself from overreacting, then you are opening yourself to allow every person that you interact with to control your emotions. And we see this all the time, right? Oh, I don't think she likes my dress. Now I'm offended. Oh, I don't think he likes, my tie. I'm offended. Oh, I don't think they like my music. Now I'm upset at them. I don't think they like, what I post on social media. Now I'm upset. I don't like that the pastor just called me out. Now I'm upset, right? And we see this all the time. We see it on social media, right? We see it all the time where people are so triggered by the most trifling things, right? One person expresses a different opinion, and now I'm upset. Or someone makes a choice that's different from the choice I would make, and now I'm upset. And so many friendships, so many relationships have ended over things that ultimately, at the end of the day, weren't that big of a deal. And what happened is love was easily provoked. What happened was we thought evil. We kept score, All right, we measured the injustice and we put ourselves at the top of the chain where I'm the one that gets to determine how I respond. I'm going to handle this. I'm not going to let the Lord handle this. I'm not going to let what I know to be true determine what I do. I'm going to let my attitude impact my actions in a negative way. And by the way, we all struggle with this, do we not? We're all guilty of this. None of us are exempt from overreacting. And in fact, even Moses wasn't guilty of, or wasn't free or exempt from overreacting. You know, we see this in Exodus 32, and I'll preface by saying this is not entirely a temperamental fit. There was some righteous anger in here, but in Exodus 32, this is the passage about the golden calf, right? And Moses is up on the mountain, and God has just given him the Ten Commandments. And then God says, oh, that's it. They've just made the golden calf. I'm done. I'm going to destroy them. And Moses says, well, hold on, Lord. If you will, you know, if you destroy your people, then all the Egyptians are just going to say that you led them out in the wilderness to destroy them. And Lord, please spare your wrath and don't destroy them. And the Lord says, okay, fine. I'm not going to destroy them. And so then Moses comes down the mountain to the people, and we read in verse 19, and it came to pass, as soon as he came nigh into the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing. It says, and his anger waxed hot. And what did he do? He took those tablets. He took the Ten Commandments that the Lord had just given him. And what did he do? He cast the tables out of his hands, and he broke them beneath the mount. And he took the calf which they'd made, and he burned it in the fire, and he ground it to powder, and he strawed it upon the water, and he made the children of Israel drink it. All right? Now, I'm willing to admit that there was some righteous anger in here, but what did he do? He took the law of God, discarded it, and then he took responsibility for how he was going to handle this. I'm going to burn this calf, and I'm going to make you drink it. All right? And of course, the Lord was good, and the Lord gave him the law again. But and Aaron accused him of overreacting. And Moses said unto Aaron, what did this people unto thee that thou hast brought so great a sin upon them? And Aaron said, Let not the anger of my Lord wax hot. Thou knowest the people that they're set on mischief. Moses, don't overreact. They're just people. Come on, get over it. And so none of us are exempt from this. That's what I set out to say. None of us are exempt from this. But the Lord does call us as believers to not be easily provoked, to not keep score of injustices and determined to do evil against one another. And so in order to apply these passages and in order to move on in the way that the Lord wants us to move on, we need to ask ourselves a couple of questions. We need to ask ourselves, where does this attitude come from? Right, we need to ask ourselves when I'm overreacting, when I'm being temperamental, when I'm being easily provoked, and when I'm thinking evil, where does that come from? And James gives us the answer. He says, every man is tempted, every man is put to the test when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. And so where does this attitude come from? It comes from me feeling like I'm entitled to be in charge, right? And whatever that lust looks like for you, ultimately it's idolatry. I want to be God. I want to determine what's right and wrong. I want to be in control of how I'm treated. And so God, thanks but no thanks, I've got this handled. And when we get to a point where we place ourselves above God in terms of priority, where does that lead us? It leads us to sin. And where does sin lead us? It leads us to death. And so where does this temperamental, overreactive response come from? It comes from me. It comes from me not getting what I think I'm entitled to, whether that's treatment, whether that's material possessions, whether that's physical relationships, whatever it is, it comes from me not getting what I think I'm entitled to. And James echoes this again in chapter 4 when he says, from whence come wars and fightings among you? Hey, why can't we get along with each other? Come they not hence, even of your lusts that war in your members? Ye lust and have not, ye kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. Ye fight and war, yet ye have not, because ye ask not. Ye ask and receive not, because ye ask amiss, that ye may consume it upon your own lusts. Why can't we get along? Because I want what I want, and you want what you want, and neither one of us want what God wants. And when I'm trying to get my way, and you're trying to get your way, and neither one of us are trying to get his way, why are we surprised that that leads to wars and fightings? Why are we surprised that we can't get along when I'm trying to get my way and you're trying to get your way and neither one of us are trying to get God's way? And so we're going to move a little more quickly now. We need to understand where it comes from, but we also need to understand what it looks like in our lives, right? A temperamental person is impatient and unkind. We already looked at that a couple verses ago. A temperamental person is self-focused. We looked at that a couple verses ago. A temperamental person is rude. We looked at that this verse. And so the summary here of a temperamental person is anyone who just wants things my way. And maybe you mean well. You know, maybe what you desire to see is something that you perceive to be good and beneficial for everybody, but ultimately, a temperamental person is someone who just wants things my way. And when I just want things my way, who am I thinking about? Me. When I'm angry and I'm keeping score because I'm not getting treated the way I think I'm entitled to be treated, who am I thinking about? Me. When I can't let go of an injustice, when I can't move forward in a relationship with someone because of something that's happened in the past, who am I thinking about? Me. Right? And so I wrote here, this is the person that flies off the handle anytime things don't go their way. This is the kid that kicks his little brother because he wants to play Xbox with his friends, but his little brother keeps bothering him. This is the kid that tells his parents he wished he was in a different family because they won't let him go out with his friends until his homework's done. This is the woman who is cold and irritable because she assumes everyone is always talking about her behind her back. This is the woman who screams at her husband because he was late getting home from work and forgot to call her, so now dinner is cold. This is the man that cusses out his supervisor because he got passed over for a promotion again. This is a man who yells and threatens and manipulates his family to get the home to be run his way. And this is something that we see modeled for us very well in the life of King Ahab. And we know this story. This is 1 Kings 21. It says, and it came to pass after these things that Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard, which was in Jezreel, hard by the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. So it was nearby, right? And so here's this guy, Naboth the Jezreelite, and he's got this vineyard, and it's near Ahab's palace in Samaria. And it says, and Ahab spake unto Naboth, saying, give me thy vineyard that I may have it for a garden of herbs, because it is near unto my house, and I will give thee for it a better vineyard than it, or if it seems good to thee, I will give thee the worth of it in money. Hey, Naboth, I like your vineyard. It's a nice vineyard. It's pretty. It's close to my house. I'd like to have it for myself. And so I'd like you to give me your vineyard, and in exchange, I will either buy you a better vineyard somewhere else, or I'll just buy it off of you. Now, is that, for all intents and purposes, a perfectly reasonable proposition? Sure. Yeah, you see a house you like, you put in an offer, right? Hey, I'd like to have your field. Here's what I'm proposing. The problem is, Naboth said no. And Naboth said to Ahab, the Lord forbid it me that I should give thee the inheritance, that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto thee. Hey, you know, Ahab, appreciate the offer, but I can't do that. I can't give you this field. You know, I know you want it. Your offer's good. Thanks, but no thanks. Now, this should be the end of the story, but unfortunately it's not. And here's where we see the temperament. Here's where we see the overreaction. And Ahab came into his house heavy and displeased. Who was he thinking about? Himself. He came into his house heavy and displeased because of the word which Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken unto him. For he had said, I will not give thee the inheritance of my fathers. And listen to this. And he laid him down upon his bed and turned away his face and would eat no bread. And so he threw a temper tantrum. He threw a temper tantrum that is on par with what you would expect from a four-year-old. And why do four-year-olds throw temper tantrums? Because they're still learning to control their temperament, right? They're still learning to exercise self-control. They're still adding, right, the faith and the virtue and the knowledge and the self-control and the endurance, right? And they're immature, right? And so we have expectations of our kids, and we disciple them, and we teach them, and we help them grow. And as we do that process, hopefully we see that growth, right? But here, Ahab, he's the king. He's like a whole adult, and he's the king of Israel in Samaria, and he's throwing a fit. He turns away his face, and he would eat no bread. And so he throws this childish little temper tantrum, and if you know the rest of the story, the temper tantrum ended up costing Naboth his life, which in turn cost Ahab and Jezebel the kingdom, right? And so his temperamental fit, it went far further than what he had originally intended, and I think if he had known in advance where that was going to lead him, he may have made a different decision. And so that goes back to the idea of endurance and planning ahead and thinking right. But we've looked at what it is, what it means, what it looks like. The most important question that we need to ask ourselves is when it comes to all of this, when it comes to the injustices that we feel, because remember, love is not easily provoked, and love thinketh no evil. When love is mistreated, it is not easily provoked, and it doesn't think evil. And so when it comes to this idea of temperament, and when it comes to this idea of responding rightly to the injustices of life, when it comes to responding rightly when things aren't exactly the way I think that I deserve for things to be, how do I fix it? And the answer is by practicing biblical forgiveness. Right? How can love not be provoked? By being quick to practice forgiveness. How can love avoid keeping score and determining to repay evil for evil? How does love avoid that? By being quick to forgive. When love is mistreated, love is able to avoid being provoked, and love is able to avoid keeping score by being quick to forgive. And so the answer to this temperamental, overreacting kind of self-centeredness is to practice biblical forgiveness. And so we need to ask ourselves, well, what is biblical forgiveness? What makes forgiveness biblical? Well, as I was studying for this message, I came across a quote, and I think it makes for a really good definition of forgiveness. And one commentator, he was talking about he was actually talking about Ephesians 4:32, which we're going to look at in a minute. But he referenced the eradication of evil words and actions accomplished through the purification of the thought life. And I thought, that's a really good definition of forgiveness. To say it this way, forgiveness is the ability to let go of injustices because I'm thinking rightly about myself and my position in sanctification. Right? When I am mistreated, here's what I do. You know what? I also mistreat people. You know what? I mistreated God. And your injustice to me, you know, it might cost me some money. It might cost me some time. It might cost me some inconvenience. It might cost me some relational strain. But you know what my injustice to God cost him? It cost him his life. It cost him his son, Jesus Christ, who died on a cross for my sins, for my injustices. All right? I saw something earlier in the week. It said, if life was fair, I'd be on the cross. How many of you guys agree with that? If life was fair, I'd be on the cross. But I didn't go on that cross. He went on that cross for me. And when I understand my position in sanctification, when I understand just how far God went to redeem me in my relationship with Him, when I realize just how far God went to make me His and to have a relationship with me, that ought to change the way I view the injustices that I suffer on a daily basis. Nothing that I suffer comes even close to what He endured for me. And if He can forgive me, then I can forgive you. And when I think, when I'm thinking right, then I'm acting right. Ephesians 4:2, it says, with all lowliness and meekness, with long suffering, forbearing one another in love. And so when it comes to my interactions with people, especially within the body of Christ, those are to be governed by lowliness and meekness. Not, hey, I'm more important. Not, hey, you should do things my way. Humility. And humility isn't thinking less of myself. Humility is thinking of myself less. And so when it comes to the interactions that I have with people, especially within the body of Christ, those are to be governed with lowliness and meekness and long-suffering, patience, endurance, and we are to forbear one another, and we're to do it in love. He says later on in Ephesians 4, verse 32, he says, be ye kind one to another. Be tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. Why am I supposed to forgive my brother? Because God forgave you. Why am I supposed to forgive my sister? Because God forgave you. Why am I supposed to forgive my coworker who said that awful thing about me? Because God forgave you. Why am I supposed to forgive that person who did that horrible, awful, terrible, unspeakable thing to me? Because God forgave you. And when I was working on my degree in counseling, a lot of case studies come across your desk that you have to write about. And there's this one case study that stood out to me. And this girl, unspeakable things. I will not say them out loud. Unspeakable things that she endured from her father and his friends at the church. Horrible things. I'm not going to say them out loud. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know if I could have responded in that situation the way she did. And it took years for her to unpack the truck. But at the end of the day, you know what it is? I can forgive that person of their unspeakable things that they've done to me because God has forgiven me of the unspeakable things that I've done to Him. And so the solution to this idea of not being temperamental, not being easily provoked, not thinking evil, not keeping score, not determining to get vengeance. The answer to all of that is biblical forgiveness, where I understand what I've been forgiven, and because of that, I take steps to forgive. We talked about this as well in Colossians 3. He says, put on therefore as the elect of God, holy and beloved, bowels of mercy, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, which is humbleness of action, long-suffering, forbearing one another and forgiving one another. And this is important. He says, if any man have a quarrel against any, even as Christ forgave you, so also do ye. And of course, this ties into Matthew 18 as well, which we referenced earlier, right? We're called to forgive. Why? Because we've been forgiven. Right, Psalm 103, verse 12, it says, as far as the east is from the west, so far hath He removed our transgressions from us. Amen. You know, when we get to heaven, God's not going to roll out the movie screen and say, okay, let's watch a blow-by-blow of everything you've ever done wrong. You're forgiven, but let's just kind of rehash it so that way you can appreciate just how good I am. That's not going to happen. God says, it is removed. As far as the east is from the west. How far away is the east from the west? They never touch. Right? You can go so far east that it feels like you're going west, but they will never touch. And He says, that's how far He has removed our transgressions from us. God does not allow my injustices to serve as a roadblock in our relationship. That's done. It is forgiven. It is nailed to the cross. It is done. And because God did that for me, I do that for others. And here's the thing. We often say, forgive and forget, forgive and forget. Well, God never forgets. God chooses to not remember. See, God isn't absent-minded. See, God isn't like, oh, I totally forgot about that. No, God is omniscient. God knows all things. God knows every single thing that I've ever done wrong. And so when it says that he forgets, he doesn't put it out of his mind, but he puts it out of his mind. He chooses to not remember. And so maybe one of you in this room has done something to another person in this room, and it's bad. But you know what? Because God forgave you, you forgive that person, and whatever that thing was that happened, it doesn't exist. We put it out of our minds, we choose not to remember, and we do not allow that injustice to in any way, shape, or form impede the relationship. Is that hard? Is that something that comes naturally? Is that something that's like easy? No. So how do we do it? By looking to Christ. He is our example of life. He is our example of love. He is our example of forgiveness. And so with the Lord's help, let us strive this week to not be easily provoked and to not think evil.